This past Monday, we finished up the discussion of the Lab 2 calculations, and there was a topic we were supposed to do that day, which is distillation, which is related to vapor pressure. But I wanted to move on to something else, the topic that's supposed to be for today, which is spectroscopy, because you have labs coming up soon that depend on understanding this technique. Now, spectroscopy mostly today, we're going to be talking about in a somewhat abstract sense, which for some of you, that makes it very frustrating, because that is a bunch of concepts and numbers and equations that you don't have any good physical relationship with, meaning that you don't have a tactile model in your head that you can go along with all the stuff you're hearing. I am going to throw in some examples of spectroscopy here and there when I can to help give a little bit more context. But today's lecture is really meant as an introduction, and then we're going to talk more specifically about certain types of spectroscopy as we go on. So before I can even talk about what spectroscopy is, that's our main topic, I got to go back and give you some background information. Because spectroscopy involves light. To go ahead and just get it over with, spectroscopy is the analysis of a sample by the use of different frequencies of light. So that's why we got to talk about what light is. And light actually comes in two formats, which is what I now realize what I need to talk about first before I even get to spectroscopy. So we're going to be reviewing some things that you might have learned in 1A just to make sure everybody's got the background to understand some of these concepts in spectroscopy. So first, let's get to electromagnetic radiation, otherwise known as light. So why this fancy term, electromagnetic radiation? Well, radiation means to, well, radiate. And as you know, if you flip on a light switch, the light will start in one source and will spread all over the place that it can. Light, when viewing it from its wave nature, acts like a sine wave. Actually, it acts like two overlapping sine waves. One of these representing an electric field, one of these representing a magnetic field. The two of these at 90 degrees to each other. So you might not be able to tell from my diagram, but it's trying to represent a wave wiggling in three dimensions. So light is a combination of oscillating electric and magnetic fields. Now, if we're going to be talking about sine waves like this, it might be useful to talk a little bit about the anatomy of a sine wave. And this is going to be very lightweight, so those of you who don't like math very much, I'm not going to give you a whole overload of math here, just enough so you understand the terminology that's going to come up in this discussion. So here I've tried to draw out a sine wave, and let's say this is something like a light or a sound wave, where the x-axis here represents distance. So I'll just say x for distance. Now, the y-axis might mean different things for different types of waves. For sound wave, it's the intensity of a sound. For light waves, it's intensity of light. So in general, there's a term representing this height difference between the center of the wave and either the top or the bottom. Does anybody know what that term is? Amplitude. Yep, that's right. Just like an amplifier is something that increases the total height of that wave, just like an audio amplifier. If this is a physical wave, which again means that the x-axis is distance, then what would we call the distance between two repetitions of this wave? Wow. Yeah, some of you are on it. That is wavelength, which is usually represented by lowercase Greek letter lambda, L. There's something else that I'm going to put on this diagram that won't apply to us now. But if we're talking about all these other terms, wavelength, amplitude, we'll get frequency in just a moment. There is this other aspect of waves we could talk about. So my drawing ability is not being perfect. This doesn't look identical, but let's pretend that we had two identical waves. But one of them starts right at zero, and one of them starts a little distance from zero. Otherwise, they're the same as each other. So, what would we refer to as that difference? Constructive and deconstructive interference. That's related to this thing I'm discussing, but that's not what this is by itself. Phase. Yes, it is. So if we say that something is in phase or out of phase, it means its starting point in the wave matches. Now, I saw several things pop up in the chat window. Is amplitude always half the wavelength, or are they unrelated? They are unrelated. It is coincidental if it looks that way on the diagram. All right, so now this is a static diagram, so I can't show frequency. What is frequency? And there's two different ways that frequency is represented. It's either as a fancy F, or, for reasons I'll learn one day, Greek letter lowercase nu, which I know looks like a V, but it's actually an N. How often a corresponding point of a wave passes a point due to time? Yes, that's what frequency is. That's how often something occurs. So, in fact, I was going to get to what are the units for frequency? 1/seconds, which is also known as a hertz. And every time I introduce that unit, I do a little public broadcast session. Meaning this, a lot of you don't really know much about the different sources of power that you use. Like, you are using a laptop, maybe, or a tablet, which means you have a charger that converts AC into DC power. So, not that I really want you to raise your hands, but just mentally, just out there, I'm wondering, how many of you actually know what the difference of what AC and DC is? And the reason that this is related to this conversation is this term hertz. So if you pick up any power adapter, like I got this one right here for my work laptop, and it says, blah, 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 blah. Where is it on this one? Here we go. Input, 100 to 240 volts, 50 to 60 hertz. Why would there be a hertz rating on here? We'll roll back 100 years ago to where the main way that power was generated was using either coal or steam or falling water or something to turn turbines. And so you come up with a power system that's this. If you take a loop of wire and you pass it the right way through a magnetic field, then it generates an electric current. So you have some kind of thing, again, steam, whatever, some power thing that doesn't involve electricity, turning this engine, turning this turbine that's got these coils that are going around the magnetic fields, or maybe the magnets are going around and it's wires around it. I should look at a picture. But anyways, it generates electric current. But because it involves rotating magnets, which have a north and a south direction to them, then you end up getting positive and negative, the current going back and forth in terms of what its voltage is. So the voltage looks just like a sine wave where it goes positive and negative. That's alternating current, AC. And that's why it says 50 or 60 hertz on your devices, because that's the frequency at which the turbines historically went, and so that's what we maintain. Now, direct current, DC, that's what is like what comes out of a battery, because there it's a permanent fixed voltage. One end is always plus, one end is always minus. And so there's no changing of that polarity. So that's fixed. That's why it's called direct current. So the last thing I'll say about all that is, if you have an older or cheaper made audio device that's plugged into the wall and you hear this low-pitched hum, that very well might be the sound of the electric power itself bleeding through into the sound coming out of that system. So anyways, there's my little public service announcement about what the power is that you're using right now. Okay, now here's back to the point with light. If we've got frequency, which we've got units of 1/seconds, and if we've got wavelength, which is meters, so we've got 1/seconds times meters, that gives us meters per second, which is what? Speed, yes, equal to C. And in this case, because we're talking about light, that is the speed of light, which for our purposes, we will say is constant. So to put it into word form, in light, wavelength and frequency are always inversely proportional. Questions so far? Now here's where I think things went wrong when I did this lecture this morning. I just introduced light as being a wave. And the part I didn't focus enough on is the fact that light also acts like a particle. So I'm going to go back and have this brief discussion with the section one when we can. I'm going to do this out loud, because I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I just want to mention it. And what it is something known as the photoelectric effect. So in case you didn't ever have that discussion in your Chem 1A class, imagine that you have a piece of metal and you have a light that's shining on that metal. And let's say this is a metal that's sensitive to light. So when I was growing up, if you had a door sensor, it wasn't radar or whatever they use now, sonar, fancy things. It was just a light beam hitting a detector, just like what I'm describing. And that detector would generate a current if the light hit it. So that's the same kind of setup in this photoelectric experiment. But it turns out that very frequently in those situations, it's not how much light that hits it that causes it to respond. It's what frequency of light it is. And that's something that confused researchers back in the early 1900s, including Einstein, the same Einstein that gave us E equals mc squared. Yeah, he was knee-deep in the photoelectric effect as well. And so the problem was, from classical physics, they didn't understand, well, why does it not matter how bright the light is? I mean, you could take, the way that I usually describe it is, let's say this metal has a certain cutoff frequency of light before it responds. So if you have light that's lower frequency, then it doesn't matter how much you use. And lower frequency, I'm just going to give it away, is red light. So you could have all the red light of all the heat lamps of all the McDonald's in the world, and it wouldn't get a response. But if you have purple light, anything that ends up being higher frequency, then that causes a response. Why? Because light doesn't end up acting just like a wave. It also ends like a particle. And it acts like a particle that we call a photon. And so there's a very important equation that's related to all this, and this is the point. So the equation is this. And let me just define what photons are. They are particles of light. What are the variables in this equation I just wrote? Delta E is the energy per photon. This thing that looks like a V, it's an N, it's the frequency. And then what's this thing in here? It's the fudge factor. It's Planck's constant. It's a measure of the granularity of the universe. Which that sounds overly poetic, but if you imagine sand, how fine are the particles of sand? How small are they? That's what granularity means. So Planck's constant tells you the size of energy packets that you get from light. Planck's constant actually shows up in lots of places, like off to the side here. You know the four quantum numbers? There's M, L, N, L, and then there's MS, right? And yes, the V is a nu. So what is MS? What are the possible values?
Positive and negative one-half?
That's right. Positive and negative one-half h divided by 2 pi. Otherwise, sometimes expressed as plus or minus one-half h bar. That h over 2 pi comes from Planck's constant. That is the true numerical value. We don't teach that because then we have to explain what Planck's constant is, and then math, and then physics, and then, yeah, at some point we draw the line. But technically, that H or H bar shows up all over the place, not just in this little equation right here. But this is the equation that tells us that the energy in a packet of light, an energy per photon, depends on the frequency of light. Coming back to the photoelectric effect, that explains why it behaved the way it does. Because if you have light that's low frequency, there's not enough energy per photon for things to happen. Once you get above a certain frequency, you have enough energy per photon for something to happen. Now, I'm going to carry this idea on a little further, and then we're going to get back to the spectroscopy part. But I did some of this in the later part of the lecture this morning and realized, no, we need to get it out of the way, so that we can build on the ideas. So let's move to the next page then. And let me look back at this morning's notes, see when I'm going to rejoin what we did. Ah, okay, there's one other thing you might have talked about in 1A, and this one I'm going to talk about for a little bit longer. There's a request to take a screenshot. Please grab your screenshot. And here we go. And I'll go back at the end of lecture to do all the slides over again for those of you who might miss ones here and there. So the topic I'd like to discuss now is atomic spectra. And morning section, if you're listening, I'm going to present this in a slightly different way, again, to help try to build on concepts. So here's the way that I normally express the topic of atomic spectra. Let's say that we have either the right kind of LED light or the old school type of light bulb like what I'm drawing here. And let's say that that is a white light. If we pass that light through a prism, then we all hopefully know what's going to happen. And I actually have all the colors to do it. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue. That's not blue. Indigo. Violet. Roy G. Biv, right? All the colors of the rainbow. If we do the same thing with a tube filled with hydrogen gas that's been electrified, it will give off this sort of eerie, purplish-bluish looking light. So that kind of gives away a little bit what's about to happen anyways. The white light, because if you never knew this before, white light is a combination of all different frequencies of light. Something different's going on with the hydrogen light. We pass this through a prism, and it turns out there are only four specific colors that come out. Now, because I referred to them this morning, and no, you don't have to memorize it at all, but these are the wavelengths of light that we would find. Wavelength is the way that I tend to talk about light in my Chem 1 classes. So these are values that I just looked up from the book. And you might have done this observation as part of your Chem 1A class. So now, what's the point of showing you this? Well, in white light, we have every frequency of light that comes out. If we already believe in photons, that means there's every energy photon coming out of that white light too. But then for hydrogen, there's only these very specific wavelengths that come out. That means the electrons are in hydrogen, it turns out, are only moving between very specific energy levels. And to give you a visual of that, imagine an incorrect picture, the Bohr picture of the model, of atomic model. And so if you have two different energy levels, which we could call those N equals 1 for the lower level, N equals 2 for the outer level, any time that you have an electron sitting in the lower level, if you have light that hits it, that can cause that electron to jump and end up at a different energy level. So that's one fundamental concept. When light strikes an electron, if the light is the correct frequency, it can be absorbed. Causing the electron to move to a higher energy level. And again, that's what that diagram is trying to depict here. that it starts out at one level, goes to a higher one. Here's the important thing. The photoelectric effect experiment, the reason it matters is it demonstrates that light, which we normally think of as a wave, actually acts like particles. Turns out electrons also act like waves. So electrons are not just particles. Wow. What did I just say? Electrons are not just particles. Wake up, Dr. Gray. They act like standing waves. That's a particular type of wave that has certain conditions associated with it. And the result is, which means, electrons can only have very specific values of energy. When electrons move between energy levels, then, they can only absorb or release specific energies. Which corresponds to specific colors of light. Better said, which correspond to specific wavelengths. Or colors of light. And I'm going to wrap this up with kind of saying the same thing. But this is the phrase you're going to hear me say when we get to spectroscopy. If light with the right frequency that corresponds to a photon, with an energy, that matches the gap between two energy levels. Hits an electron. That light can be absorbed. So far in this lecture, I've developed a little bit about what light is in terms of its wave characteristics. So we talked about frequency and we talked about wavelength. And then I got to photons. And that's where we went into a brief review of the photoelectric effect, but we spent more time on this topic of atomic spectra. Because this is the one case in Chem 1A where you have at least some familiarity with quantization of energy. The fact that electrons can only happen at certain energy levels. And so that is the observed result of seeing something like hydrogen gas being electrified. Since it's specific atoms that are absorbing and releasing light, those energy levels are very specific, which is why there's only specific wavelengths or frequencies of light that are observed. Now, let's go back, now that we've gotten all the fundamentals out of the way, and let's talk about the electromagnetic spectrum. So what is a spectrum? It's a range of frequencies, or remember that frequencies and wavelength are related. So it's a range of wavelengths or frequencies of light. And I'm going to give you a brief introduction to the full electromagnetic spectrum. Now, I tend to do things in terms of wavelength. So I'm going to write low wavelength on the left-hand side. And that means high wavelength on the right-hand side. To some people, that will seem backwards. Because if you remember that frequency and wavelength are inversely proportional for light, then that means that I'm going to have high-frequency light on the left-hand side and low-frequency light on the right-hand side. And here's why then people might think this is backwards. Because that means that you have high photon energy on the left and low photon energy on the right. This is why I wanted to talk about photons before I talked about a spectrum, so I could relate frequency, wavelength, and photon energy all together at the same time. Okay, since we humans are it's all about us, isn't it? So we humans observe in the visible range of light. So I'm going to put it smack in the middle of here. And if I were to give you really, really rounded numbers of where visible light shows up, a very rough approximation is 400 to 700 nanometers. If you only wanted one significant figure in your numbers, then from 400 to 700. Now, we already had the discussion of high photon energy, low photon energy, high frequency, and all that. So which side of this graph is violet light going to show up, left or right?
Left.
This is why it's this region of the spectrum that tends to be more harmful physiologically, because there's more oomph per photon that's shooting at it. So there's our visible light with approximate ranges. Now, what do we have if we go just to the left of visible light? What do we have there?
Ultraviolet.
Which there are, there may be many, but I'm not a biologist. I remember as a child watching a program about it, and I think butterflies are able to see in the UV spectrum, so what they observe flowers to look like could be strikingly different than what we observe flowers to look like. UV light, more energy per photon. This is the range of light that's harmful when you go out. The reason you wear sunscreen is not because of the red light, it's because of this ultraviolet light. Ultraviolet can come in a range of wavelengths itself. And there's very specific wavelengths that are used in certain applications. So if you ever buy a UV lamp, let's say that you're a geologist, different ranges of UV can cause different color patterns to occur because chemistry. Anyways, that's the UV range. What would come to the left of that?
I think gamma.
That's a little further.
Oh, man. X-ray.
X-ray, you got it. And then, yes, we would get to gamma rays, which go through everything. These are high-energy photons. They pass through everything. Now let's go to the other end of the spectrum. What do you get when you go past red?
Infrared.
This is where heat cameras operate. And then beyond that, who's good with their
microwave?
Microwaves, that's right. Just like your microwave ovens, happens to excite a certain motion of water. It's just in the right range for that to make water wiggle like crazy, which is what heats things up. It's kind of a simplified explanation, but that's basically it. And then past microwaves, radio. Each one of these regions of the spectrum, except maybe gamma rays, because I don't know a lot about those. Each of these regions is used somehow in spectroscopy. Spectroscopy, because I've got the room right below it to put it here. What is spectroscopy? It's analysis of a sample. Using a range of frequencies of light. And again, I'll say wavelengths or frequencies. So in terms of UV light and visible light, if we combine the two of those together, we get what's called UV-Vis, which is where electronic transitions occur. In other words, that's where we see things. And so transition between energy levels of electrons normally show up in this range of the spectrum. In terms of infrared, that's where you have the actions of bonds. So if you have atoms that are connected to each other, and you can imagine the atoms vibrating back and forth like a spring, well, these kinds of wiggling motions of bonds tend to show up in the infrared range of the spectrum. The radio wave range. She sells seashells by the seashore. So this region right here, this is where nuclei can be affected, which I yet again had to do a little bit of lecture from my car this morning because, excuse me, I took someone in because they were having an MRI. If you don't know what that is, that's where you get put in a box with this huge magnet. These magnets are strong enough that if you have any metal in you, it'll rip it out because they are Tesla-level magnetic fields, which means super strong. In fact, they're not the normal magnets like what you have in a fridge. They're not iron or some metal base. They're superconducting magnets. And they have to be because you have to generate these huge electric fields to generate these magnetic fields that are strong enough to do their business. And what they do is they cause nuclei to align with or against that magnetic field. And then what you can do is zap anything that's in that magnetic field with light. And certain frequencies of light will be absorbed because of the nuclei flipping back and forth between being aligned with and against the magnetic field. So you need the magnetic field to create the energy levels, and then light causes the nuclei to bounce between energy levels. That's what's going on inside of you if you ever have an MRI. Now, in chemistry land, we have something called NMR, which is nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy, and the same thing happens. You put a sample into this magnet, very powerful magnet, it causes nuclei to get energy levels, you scan it with light, and the really small differences that you detect in those frequencies that you absorb, that's what in biological samples gets translated as different tissue. In chemistry land, we can actually use the complexity of the spectra we get to come up with the structure of a compound. It's not quite like Star Trek where you just put it in a box and the computer tells you what it is. Not yet. But you, if you take organic chemistry, will use an NMR to prove that you synthesize certain compounds. Now, I didn't even get to x-rays, which x-rays, you all know that if you've ever had an x-ray at the dentist, those are photons that can penetrate through you. Not as well through bone, which is why they're used in dental x-rays and such. X-rays, though, can be used also for what's known as crystallography. If you can imagine a pattern of atoms, which, let me see if I can pull up a picture, because, you know, if only I was connected to a device where I could look up images and things and display them, you know, like a computer or something like that. And here is as good a picture as I'm going to find in a hurry. So one moment here. One moment.
So an MRI is kind of like a prism for humans?
That's a very loose way of putting it, but sort of. An MRI puts you in a magnet, and the magnet makes, in particular, hydrogens. Hydrogens are very responsive, and you got an awful lot of hydrogen in you. So hydrogens get oriented up or down compared to that magnetic field. Those are two energy levels, usually in science called alpha and beta. You hit it with the right kind of light, nucleus jumps from one energy level to another. Depending on what's around the nuclei, you have these subtle effects that change the frequencies, and that's how you can tell what you got. Now, this thing you're looking at on the screen right now is a crystal structure. It is a pattern of atoms that's very rigid, very well defined. And so it's some type of substance that managed to form into a very nicely crystalline pattern. What happens is if you shoot x-rays at something like this, you get like this sparkle pattern of all the x-rays bouncing back off again. And you can use math in order to come up with the position of all these atoms. And I always give this example because this is the reason I don't talk about names in science. You know, when we were talking about gas laws, I didn't mention the names Boyle's Law or Charles' Law or the different names, because in different textbooks, they're different. And in different countries, they might be different. And of course, whoever shows up in the textbooks, it's like a little bit like history. It's whoever won that ends up in them. And so whoever gets the credit is not always the person that really did all the work. And in X-ray crystallography, there's a famous example where you have, have you all ever heard of Crick and Watson?
That name? No, never.
Well, that's because your books might have already changed. When I was growing up, Crick and Watson were the people that you learned that discovered DNA. That was the simplified story. What they often didn't tell you is that it was a woman that was the spectroscopist who actually did the work, came up with the structure. Is it Rosalind Franklin? Let me look that name up. Someone's asking me right now, and I just suddenly forgot the name. DNA crystallography. Rosalind Franklin. I got the name mixed up. Rosalind Franklin, yes. And I believe what happened is she passed right as the research was getting published. She was awfully young. And I think that's why she didn't get the credit that she might have otherwise gotten. So I always use that as an example to explain why do I not talk about names in science. It's because unless you really do your research and you're really aware, you might just be misleading people repeating the names. Anyways, that's a total side topic. let me get back to what we're supposed to be doing because we're going to run out of time. And it's, I think it's Rosalind. I said Rosamund, so I was close, but I think it is Rosalind, just to give her proper credit. Okay, so now we've got a range of frequencies of light. We've got spectroscopy. Now I've got to tell you what spectroscopy is, which now that's the easy part. All this background, that's the tough part. Spectroscopy itself is often very simple. And this is kind of cartoonish, the way I'm going to draw this. Obviously, the innards and the mechanics of these machines are much more complicated than what I'm going to show here. But any form of spectroscopy, there's something that generates light. So I'll just say it is the light source. In lab, you would have used a UV-Vis spectrometer. So it would have generated light in the UV or visible wave ranges. And it actually has a big giant knob you could use to adjust the wavelength or the frequency. Often what you do is then you pass the light through a sample. Some of that light gets absorbed, some of it gets passed on. And it can hit some form of detector, which someone this morning commented, well, that kind of looks like an eye, and that's kind of what I meant. Oh yeah, Hidden Figures, that was an interesting film. So the detector, that's like the eye in science. You're looking at what's the light that comes through. So when light passes through the sample, or actually, let me word this a little better. One moment. In spectroscopy, oh gosh, where'd I go? Uh-oh, running with scissors. Hold on. Lab. There. So in spectroscopy, a sample is irradiated with a range of frequencies of light. Okay, sorry about that. So in spectroscopy, a sample is irradiated with a range of frequencies of light. Those frequencies that match energy gaps in the sample will be absorbed. By analyzing which frequencies of light are absorbed, some aspect of the structure of the substance can be determined. What that is depends on the type of light used. That's why I mentioned For example, IR light being associated with bonds, UV light being associated with electrons. So depending on which type of light you use, that'll tell you the information that you can get back from a sample. So the last thing I wanted to show you then is what an example spectrum might look like. So please take your screenshots before we go to our last page. All right. So to mention it, there are two different units that are often used in spectroscopy, and it depends on your application. So the simpler unit is transmittance. Oops. And that is literally the percentage of light that passes through the sample. And of course, the maximum transmittance you can have is 1, meaning 100%. Then there's another related unit, which is absorbance, which is the same thing for transmittance as pH is for hydrogen, meaning it is equal to the negative base 10 log of transmittance, and that's transmittance as a decimal, not percentage. Why would you use the different units? Transmittance can be used, as you'll learn, if you're just trying to determine where a sample is sensitive to light. So where the transmittance drops, you know that's a wavelength or frequency that sample is sensitive to. But absorbance, we're going to learn later on, can be directly related to certain properties of a substance, like, or a sample. For example, if you have a mixture, if you have a solution, you can sometimes relate absorbance to the concentration of that solution. So here, then, is what a graph would look like if we were using absorbance as our axis. So that would be on the y-axis. X-axis, for example, if we were doing this in lab, you'd be running roughly those 400 to 700 nanometers of visible light. Now, in a very idealized substance, your graph might look something like this. Oop, let me try that again. Now, substances don't always absorb at just one wavelength or frequency. You can see this has a little broad distribution. Sometimes there might be multiple highest points, which in a graph like this, this is referred to as a peak, just like a mountain peak. The wavelength that this occurs at is often called lambda max, which means the wavelength.
Professor, what does that T stand for?
Transmittance.
And also, does it say 1 next to or in the parentheses?
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
So here, lambda max, that's wavelength of maximum absorbance. That means the wavelength at which the absorbance reaches its top. That can be used to analyze a substance. For example, if you were doing, if you made a specific substance that had a very characteristic wavelength of absorbance, you could very quickly use the absorbance at just that lambda max to determine something about the concentration of the solution. You don't have to look at all these other wavelengths. So now, why would it be this specific wavelength that it absorbs at? something to do with the energy levels in the sample. Why doesn't it all absorb at exactly the same wavelength? That's a little bit complicated and beyond the topic for today. But we finally got to the point, because this is the type of graph you would be generating in real life. The very first experiment, if I recall, that you used spectroscopy, at least historically, it was where you would generate a graph like this, come up with which wavelength a substance responds to the most, and then you would analyze substances at that wavelength to come up with their concentration. And we're going to get to that lab a little bit later on in the quarter. Questions? All right, I'm not going to take too much time to do this, but in the morning, I did talk about the answers to the quiz. So I know it would make more sense to talk about these answers if you had them in front of you. You do have the blank copies you can still look at on Canvas, because I have not turned off the Canvas assignments yet, so you're still able to get to it. And then most of what I'm about to say, I'm not going to write, only because it's mostly in the notes. So especially for the first three questions, almost all of that is directly out of the notes. First question was about ideal gases and the fact that in class we had talked about three assumptions we make related to ideal gases. You were asked to state what these assumptions were and explain how each assumption had a corresponding effect on physical properties. Well, the three we did in class were very subtly different than what's in the text. It was the fact that particles shouldn't occupy any volume because that would affect the volume of the container that you're going to measure. They can collide, but they shouldn't otherwise interact with each other. And if they interacted with each other, that doesn't really change their energy. It changes how they interact with the container. So that would have a more direct effect on pressure. And then finally, when they collide, they're not supposed to lose any energy. Because if they did, then that would affect temperature. So that's straight out of one of the past lectures. That's the only reason I'm not writing this down. Now, second question. That was about vapor pressure. So the picture is similar to a situation we discussed in class. Imagine that you put water in a container and somehow got rid of all of the air. You go back later and you measure and you find out there's water vapor there, even though you had gotten rid of all the air. And the question is why? And the answer is the graph, the energy distribution graph, which we talked about multiple times on Monday, being, or maybe it was last week, or both, being related to vapor pressure, that at any temperature, there's some fraction of molecules that have the energy to evaporate. Now, next question, that was related to our in-class examples of gas problems. So there were two different there were three types of systems we talked about. We talked about a metal can, a balloon, and a piston. And this problem had two of those. So we had a box, an indestructible metal box that started out at 4 liter size, and we also had a 4 liter sized balloon. Now, both of these were filled at 45 degrees Celsius and 755 torr. And the question said, both of them are put in a freezer. And the end of...
Are you writing down? Because I can't see it on the screen.
Oh,
are you
one second. It stopped sharing for some reason. Okay, there you go. So what ends up happening, you put it into a freezer where it's still the same pressure, it's still 755 torr. But it ends up at negative 25 degrees Celsius. So the question is, what's the size and the pressure in each one of the containers? And that's actually the end of the question. First, it asks you conceptually what's going on in each of these cases. So in both cases, the molecules slow down. As you lower temperature, average kinetic energy drops. For the metal box, I said it's indestructible. So that means it doesn't change size. It's 4 liters. For the balloon, it will change size until its inside and outside pressures are the same, which means it's automatically going to end up at 755 torr. Now, for the balloon, we could start out with the expression P1V1 over T1 is equal to P2V2 over T2. But the balloon doesn't change pressure, so we can get rid of pressure from the equation. And so that turns into just V1 over T1 is equal to V2 over T2. Well, V1 is 4 liters. T1 has to be in Kelvin, which at original temperature is 45 plus 273, which is 318 Kelvin. Then that's going to equal what? Well, what we're solving for, V2, and that's going to be over the new temperature of 248 Kelvin. And so when you solve, what you get is 3.12 liters. Now we take a very similar approach with the box. Again, we could start with P1V1 over T1 is equal to P2V2 over T2. But here, the volume won't change. So that turns into P1 over T1 is equal to P2 over V2. So the pressure was 755. And yes, we can use torr because we're not using the ideal gas law equation. So we don't have to worry about our value of R. So this is over 318 Kelvin. And then we're solving for the new pressure at 248 Kelvin. And so in this case, the new pressure I got to be 589 torr. And yes, it's fine if you convert it to atmospheres, as long as you got the right value. So there's the answers to problem 3, the mathematical part. Last part of the question, if you want to go ahead and please get your screenshots. Then problem 4, you had a gas that you were given the quantity. You were told that you had 0.25 moles of hydrogen gas. And you had it at two different sets of conditions. You were told that you had 293 Kelvin at 745 torr. And you were also told that you had STP, which means, historically, 273 Kelvin and 760 torr, or in other words, one atmosphere. So if PV equals NRT, well then V is equal to NRT over P. So solving in the first case, N is moles, 0.25, R, the value that you know, has atmosphere as unit. And I know I'm being lazy with units because I'm running low on time, so I'm trying to write fast. But because we have to have atmospheres, we have to take the pressure and divide it by 760 in order to get atmospheres. And when you crunch all this, I get 6.13 liters. Then the second parts work very similarly. It's 0.25 moles. Again, the constant of 0.0821. 273 Kelvin for STP. And the volume is, or the pressure is, 1. And I got 5.60 liters.